Hi, this is Joe Montana.
This is Dak Prescott.
Hey, this is Jason Kelce, and you're listening to Rob Motti.
Rob Motti.
Rob Motti.
I am Rob Motti, and welcome to the AP Pro Football Podcast. March is here, and a new NFL league year is less than 2 weeks away. AP Pro Football writer Barry Wilner will join me to talk about the virtual combine, J.J. Watt's new home, and more. Stay tuned for Barry. And former New York Jets wide receiver and NFL record holder, Ron Dixon, is our special guest. We'll talk about his career, playing in a Super Bowl as a rookie, and a very interesting new show that he's working on. So Ron will be coming up also. But let's kick it off with Barry Wilner. Barry, J.J. Watt found a new home, and pretty quickly. I love that he announced it himself, a two-year deal with the Arizona Cardinals, $23 million guaranteed. He's going to be 32 this month, and he had a five-sack season, played a full year. What do you think of the deal for the Cardinals?
I think it's a good deal both ways. The Cardinals are only committed for 2 years, and it's not an astronomical number. It's a high number, and so Watt is getting what he feels he's worth. This is not the same J.J. Watt who dominated teams and dominated games back in the last decade. But he can be a terrific leader on that team. He doesn't have to do everything like he often had to do in Houston. And if Chandler Jones comes back and is healthy, that's a nice 1-2 combo for rushing the passer. If they can re-sign Haason Reddick, there's another guy who can do it. I think it's a nice move, and it's also telling people around the league and the fans that the Cardinals are serious about making that next step up.
Watt's played 8 games or less in 3 of the last 5 seasons. Overall, he's played a full 16 7 times. How much of an injury risk do you think he is at this point of his career?
Yeah, I agree with that. He is an injury risk. I think the Cardinals are willing to take that risk in the hope that, number one, they don't have to play him as many plays as he had to play in Houston.
That's a good point.
That led to some of those injuries. And also with the idea of the impact he's going to have. Now, sometimes you sign a guy not just for what he can do on the field, but for what he can do in the locker room. And I'm not comparing Watt to the Tom Brady situation in Tampa, but there are some similarities.
Arizona was 8-8, and they had a disappointing finish. They started 5-2, ended up going 3-6 last 9 games. They haven't made the playoffs since 2015. But right after this signing, I saw that the odds for them on winning the NFC West shifted from 7-1 to 6-1. It is still, to me, a very tough division, the NFC West. Do you think right now it's way too early, but just based off the J.J. Watt signing, are they a playoff team?
I think all 4 teams in that division could be a playoff team. That's the best way to put it. I expect to turn around and come back from the 49ers this year. There's just too much talent on that team. And they were hit by injuries worse than almost anybody last season after a Super Bowl season. So my guess is that will again be the toughest division in the league. And any of those 4 teams could win it.
Barry, we're going to see more veterans like J.J. Watt on the move. Some are going to get released as teams deal with a smaller salary cap. The Vikings are moving on from Kyle Rudolph. Who else do you anticipate being a cap casualty in the next? I'll tell you one guy. I think Zach Ertz is definitely out the door in Philly, and I think it's a matter of does he get released or do the Eagles end up trading him for some sort of draft pick? Are there any guys that you think are going to be surprise veterans on the move?
Rather than give you specific guys, Rob, this is what I'll say about that situation. Is teams are going to move on from players who might be 1 year away from that decision. In other words, they'll make that decision this year, the team, to move on from a guy who's got a year or two left of value to them because they won't have the money under the salary cap. And next year's salary cap could go pretty high with new TV deals. So it's going to be seen across the league. Rudolph's a good example of it. He still had enough value to remain with the Vikings. But they're seeing that, first of all, the Vikings have a bunch of issues they need to address on both sides of the ball. And secondly, they have a quarterback who's making so much money that was guaranteed and they can't do anything with him. So this is the kind of move they make. And I think we're going to see a lot of those once the salary cap is set, and that should be coming up very soon.
Well, the floor moved a couple of weeks ago, the minimum, from 175 to 180. How much higher do you think it can go once the TV deals are finalized?
Well, I don't think the TV deals have any impact on this year's salary cap. I think it's going to go up to about 183. That's what I've been hearing. You know, the NFL didn't lose money. People must understand that the pandemic didn't cause NFL teams to, you know, be looking for handouts. But the revenues, obviously, that came in were slowed so much. So the NFL just simply didn't make the kind of money it's been making. And once the TV deals hit every NFL team's value, you know, the Cowboys worth what? $500 billion or something? And you're going to see those kind of crazy values for teams as we move forward.
Speaking of the Cowboys, Dak Prescott situation, how do you see that being ending up? Because there was a report that came out this week that said he's looking for money in the neighborhood of what Patrick Mahomes got, which I don't think he's going to get. And at this point, I don't think he deserves Patrick Mahomes' money. He got it after winning a Super Bowl. Do you anticipate him just getting the franchise tag one more year, or the Cowboys giving him a long-term deal?
First of all, the Cowboys are $5 billion, not $500 billion. But if they were worth that, then Jerry Jones could pay anything he wanted to anybody. It's such an interesting dynamic. I think that the Cowboys are really messed up on this, because if they really have believed that Dak is their guy, they needed to get this deal done last year. Well before the pandemic hit, well before he got hurt. And, you know, it's very much like a Kirk Cousins deal in Washington, except, you know, Dak's younger. I think he's more accomplished than Kirk Cousins was. Mm-hmm. And yet they're playing this game where they can't seem to reach the right number. I think that they will wind up franchising him again, but I think it's a mistake. I think the Cowboys need to find the money. And with the lower salary cap, maybe the money's not there, and they're going to have to deal with a situation where next year, unless Dak has another injury-filled year this year or a bad year, he's going to command so much money, they might have to let him.
Jets GM Joe Douglas said this week, Barry, that he will field calls on Sam Darnold, of course, as expected, but he said he still believes in him and his skill and his talent. He has to say that, because you're not going to, if you're at all considering trading Sam Darnold, you're not going to say that you want to trade Sam Darnold. What do you anticipate the Jets ending up doing?
It's the third time I've been asked that question today. and I can give three different answers, Rob. The Jets control the draft, because we know Trevor Lawrence is going to Jacksonville. And the Jets are in a terrific position there at number two, with so many teams eager to move up to that number two for whoever they're looking at, and in a position with other draft picks that they can combine them and really have a strong effect on what happens in that first round. So if they are in love with a quarterback in this class, that's probably where they'll wind up going. I still think there's a possibility they could trade down a little bit and still get that quarterback. The one thing I don't think they're going to do is trade for Deshaun Watson. I just don't, not of what Houston is apparently asking for, which is basically stripping his team of two drafts, you know, in a row. I can't see that. And I think if they do draft the quarterback, I don't know how they can keep Darnold on board as a backup or as the guy who would play until the rookie, you know, made his mark and became the starter. It's an intriguing position for a team that tends to mess up in the draft. And I think we're going to be wondering about this right up till April, 29th?
Yeah, you're right. And that's interesting. I didn't think of it the way you did. But the Jets do, in a way, control the draft, because we know Trevor Lawrence will be taking it to one to Jacksonville. And then the chips are going to start to fall after that. Barry, the NFL Combine was the last event last year that was not affected by COVID-19. This year, of course, it will be, and it will be held virtually. Teams are going to complain because that's what they do, but how much do you think it really impacts their ability to evaluate their potential draft picks by having to do this virtually?
It changes a lot, actually. Obviously, the film of players doesn't change much, but remember, some teams didn't play a lot of games. Some of these guys didn't play a lot of games, and then there were guys who opted out and didn't play at all last season. So that's a big impact. Then the other thing would be a lot of these teams are going to be going to pro days, but pro days are choreographed.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not sure how much you learn about a player on the field. You may learn a little bit more with interviews, but almost all interviews are going to be done virtually this leading up to the draft. So I think all of this has a pretty big impact. I don't think that teams will use it as an excuse because they put so much money and manpower into the draft anyway. But it's going to make for some really interesting news conferences after the first round of the draft when we are asking these general managers and coaches why they went in a certain direction, particularly if they draft players who opted out or barely played less.
That's a good point. You wrote a nice story this week on the NFL's fifth annual Women's Career in Football Forum. There were 40 women, I believe, who were invited to attend it virtually. What stood out to you about this event as you were putting that story together?
It's a great event in which the NFL gets involved from every level. This one had Roger Goodell and his wife, Jane, who have really pioneered having this event. It's run by Sam Rappaport, who is in charge of much of the NFL's diversity. And I was so struck by how many women have jobs in the NFL already on every kind of level, including coaching. And we know that there were two female coaches in the Super Bowl. And Bruce Arians is one of the real champions of the cause. And Rob, something I looked up today, I was writing a story about Dee Haslam and Sheila Ford Hemp, who talked at the forum. How many teams do you think have women, either owners or in very high level roles, making key decisions in the league? What would you guess?
And less than a handful.
It's 11.
Wow.
And that's a shocking number, including some women who really do make the top decisions, including Sheila Ford Hemp, who took over the Lions before last season. And it's just, to me, that number really stands out. And you'll find in the league office, many of the major jobs are women in the job. It's just a great sign of the diversity that we're seeing throughout a league where we hear about, and it's very true, the negative in coaching hires in diversity. But when it comes to women, the NFL is making some really good strides.
Well, it was a really cool story, so I encourage everybody to check it out. Barry, look forward to chatting again next week. Thank you.
You bet, Rob.
Ron Dixon played three seasons in the NFL with the Giants from 2000 to 2002. He is the only player in NFL history with two kickoff returns for a touchdown in a single postseason. Ron will be hosting a travel adventure series called To the Max that premieres this fall on NBC Sports Network. Here is my conversation with Ron Dixon.
Ron, the first NFL playoff game that I ever covered was Eagles-Giants, January 7, 2001. And the opening kickoff, man, you take it 97 yards for a touchdown. You guys go on to beat the Eagles without even scoring an offensive touchdown. Seahorn returned a pick for a score, too, as well. It's 20 years later, I know. But what do you remember about that?
You know, I remember us doing pregame, right? And I told some of my guys, I was like, listen, guys, and just get in the way, right? I don't need a kill block. I don't need you to put the guy on the ground. I'm gonna be there for a count, I promise you. You know, and that's one of the things that stuck out to me. And then, you know, you know, right before the kickoff, you know, I was doing the pointing, you know, because I was pointing to my mom and I'm letting them know, hey, I'll come. I'm going to bring it all the way back. So, you know, just to see the atmosphere of it being the playoffs, you know, and what it meant for the Giants at the time, and just the whole timing of it, with me coming from Lambeth, and now I'm in big New York and playing the Giants, and it's the playoffs, and then the first play is a touchdown. Like, it was amazing.
And you guys end up going to the Super Bowl that season, lose to the Ravens, but the only touchdown in that game was you again returning a kickoff. I believe it was also 97 yards for a score. What was that whole experience like for you, Ron? You're a rookie, like you said, coming from Lambeth, and here you are. You get into the Super Bowl, your first season in the NFL, and you set a record with two kickoff returns for scores in the playoffs. How did that, you know, that whole experience for you, what was it like?
You know, I tell people it was like entering into a different world, you know, to actually stepping out of a nightmare and into a dream. You know, it was that amazing. And the transition was that quick and that complete, you know, from going to Lambeth University to where I was playing in front of 100 people to playing in the Super Bowl, where now I'm playing in front of 100 countries. You know what I mean? So it was an amazing time, an amazing moment. And just to see how it unfolded, you know, it was almost like a movie script.
Now, I read that you had planned to retire and become an actor if the Giants would have won that game. I mean, rookie season, that's it. You were ready to move on.
I mean, just think about that. I come from Little Lambeth University, finally accomplished my dream. If I win the Super Bowl straight after doing all that, what else is next? Going straight to Hollywood. Just keep the, you know, jumping and taking it from level to the next level.
Now, tell me a little bit about coming from Lambeth. Obviously, the odds were stacked against you. You had to overcome obstacles. You had to overcome a lot of adversities. What did you learn from that entire experience? Because you ended up being a third-round pick, which means as a third-round pick, you're going to make the roster, which you did. But what was that learning experience like for you, small school to big time?
Well, the thing about it is I was recruited highly by Division I schools coming out of high school. Right. So my plans would go to the Gators and, you know, all that. But I put myself in a situation where it wasn't really active in class or really giving it my 100% all. And so I put myself in a bad situation, you know, but I turned that, which are those lemons into lemonade, so to speak, and was able to get back in school and really handle my business. And once I got there, mentally, I had made up my mind that I was coming there to deliver in the classroom and especially on the football field. You know, so transitioning from that small school just made me appreciate that situation even more and really be able to take advantage of the opportunity that I had.
You played with guys like Tiki Barber, Amani Toomer, Seahorn, Strahan. What are some of your favorite memories with any of those guys or really any of your teammates?
You know, I think it was just the way all three of those guys that you mentioned just kind of took us new guys under their wing. You know, I didn't feel the hazing that's discussed. I didn't feel the competitiveness far as you're the new guy type of deal with Amani, you know, because they had, you know, Strahan, Tiki, these are in the Manu guys who had been there for a few years. And so they had made their mind up. They knew what the team, what they wanted the team to be and what the potential and capabilities were. And I was just able to come in and, you know, get up under their tutelage. And we didn't seal the deal in the Super Bowl, but we got close.
Do you maintain relationships? A lot of guys tell me the biggest thing they miss about football is the relationships and the camaraderie in the locker room. Are you friends with anybody 20 years later? Do you have a certain kind of a close bond with any of those guys?
Yeah, you know, I keep in touch with a lot of guys, Amani, Tabidi Davis, a few other guys. Actually, Amani is one of the guys who's going to come on my show to the max. We'll discuss that later on. But, you know, a lot of those guys, you don't go to school with them. You don't grow up as children. You may spend two or three, maybe if you're lucky, 5 or 6 years with them. And it's a business, you know, so you don't, a lot of times you don't build that camaraderie with everybody, but with the few you do, you enjoy it.
Sean Payton was the Giants offensive coordinator your three seasons there. Did you see anything out of Sean during that time that would have suggested this guy's going to go on and be a very successful head coach for a long period of time in the league?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. From day one, just seeing Coach Payton, how he commanded the offense, how he put it all together, how we would go over in meetings, how detailed he was about everything, and of how creating the scheme to really light it up and get the football down the field. So I definitely, I'm definitely not surprised about his success.
There were a couple other future head coaches. Jason Garrett was a backup quarterback at one point there. Dan Campbell, who is now the Lions head coach, was a tight end for the Giants. What did you see out of either of those guys that projected them as future coaches?
Well, like you said, JG, Jason Garrett was a second string quarterback. So that means him and I were interacting a great deal. With me being a new guy there, him trying to really lend a hand to help, you know, push me and make sure that I was able to understand the offense and really put me in a position that I could be successful. So, and then Dan Campbell, just his work ethic when he was there playing tight end. I remember a lot of times afterwards how we would work, you know, on ball drills with Coach Pope and, you know, just passing, just different hand and eye coordination drills. You know, so you start looking at people who taking that extra, that time to get better, you know, just working on details. And, you know, those are the type of people I think that go off and be great coaches.
Did that ever enter your thinking, the possibility of coaching at any level?
Not at all. I've never wanted to coach on any level. I've never wanted to be a sports analyst because I didn't want to watch football long enough to speak about it intelligently and eloquently. You know what I mean? So once I was done with it, like for me, football was all about the adrenaline rush. You know, it was about the excitement. So now I can't do that. For me, it's all about taking it to the max now.
So when that knee injury ends your career after three seasons, how difficult was the transition to the real world to find something that gave you that adrenaline rush?
I would say it was very difficult. You know, I've always expressed and I tell people, like, if you can read, write, and do arithmetic in America, like, you're halfway to where you want to be. You know, the other 50% is understanding your direction and then just being persistent, right? But before you can become persistent, you have to have a direction. And that's the most difficult part, is having, finding that direction. Now, if you've been playing football since you was 5 years old and you, that's what you're all about, now you're 25, you're trying to, you have to retire. Like, now what do you do? Like, where do you find that same excitement? You know, and for me, I had to look into myself to really see what it is and what I wanted. And for me, like I said, it's all about the excitement. It's all about the adrenaline rush, and, you know, and that's how to the max it's, came about.
Now, that's true. The Max is an extreme travel adventure show, and it's set to premiere NBC Sports Network in the fall. How did the idea for this show, Ron, how did that come about?
Well, you know, once I retired, you know, I'm figuring out different things I wanted to do. And I actually was attending Strayer University, going back to school to finish my degree in international business. And one particular day, you know, I was brushing my teeth and I was like, you know what, man, I can do that, but I'm not really going to do it. You know, so I had to have that meeting with myself to where, like, OK, well, let's take some inventory in our capabilities. Like, what are we good at? Right. You know, what is it you actually want to do? You know, and having that conversation with myself, you know, I sat down and I watched Samantha Brown. She had a show on Travel Channel. But she just basically go around the world just having an amazing time. I was like, you know what? That's what I want to do. Right. And so I just started thinking and thinking and thinking. And that's how I came up with the show. I woke my wife up like 3 o'clock in the morning. And I was like, hey, what do you think about this idea for a TV show? She's like, it's great. I go to sleep. You know, so it was one of those type of things of how I came up with the show to the max.
Now, you guys are going to start shooting in May. Is there anything that you can share? You mentioned Imani is going to be part of it. As far as, can you share any guests, any type of adventures, what you guys are planning to do?
Our adventures is we're going to be in Pamplona, Spain, running with the bulls. We're going to bungee jump out of a helicopter into a live volcano. So little things like that. But the big thing is that, you know, it's going to be surprise. So the basic premise is about me trying to find that same adrenaline rush I got from playing in the Super Bowl. So we're going to be in Spain running with the Bulls. We're going to be in Pucón, Chile. But the twist is they just want to know what the adventure is going to be. So, you know, like I said, it could be my guy, Monty Toomer, who I know are afraid of heights. And we're doing a military halo jump that day from 30,000 feet. You know, so the show is not just about retired players or life after the game. It's about something that connects us all as people. Right. Like we all have excitement, adventure and travel. We're going to take those elements and tell this amazing story that's going to be full of success and sacrifice. You know, and one of the great things about it is we want to have NFL guys, Major League Baseball guys, soccer guys. We also want to have some former female professional athletes on as well. Right. So we have some great partners that we're working with now, different brands that we're working with. And, you know, we created a way to really create a situation where there's high value for other partners that want to be a part of it. So we're excited and we think we're going to knock it out of the park, like I said before.
Well, you were a kick returner, which is pretty adventurous. You got to run into guys who are coming at you as fast as possible in the piles. And there's quite an adrenaline rush there. If I ask you, what's the craziest thing you've done? Is it returning a football or is it something outside off the field?
No, actually, my wife and I, we went skydiving. I think it was like at 18,000 feet when she was pregnant. So
wait,
that was about it. She was pregnant. Yeah.
And yeah, what was that experience like? Did that spur this on?
I mean, when people ask me that, I tell them, you know, exactly what I just said. Hey, my wife went skydiving when she was pregnant. I mean, but technically she was, but we didn't know it.
Oh.
Right. But in your mind, you saw the belly and everything. You know what I mean? So it had the effect that I wanted. But yeah, that's so far. That's it, man. And so we just started planning out a lot of great locations. We have a lot of great people on the team that's put together. But Chad Zoll and the production company, 7-time Emmy winning team, Eric Leopardi, Emmett Leopardi, the brain media, you know, so they've come on board. That's really here to help take it to the next level.
Have you recruited all the guys that you want who are going to be involved in this, or is there still a little bit of a recruiting process trying to bring guys on to try out some of these adventures, especially if they don't know what they're going to do?
Right. Well, what I've done is I've reached out to like personal friends that I'm connected to, you know, Tiki Barber, Santana Moss, Brandon Mayweather, you know, all these guys, Monty Toomer. But there are like other different partners that we're going to work with and want to work with. So we want to remain flexible because they may have a athlete that they're connected to that they want to, you know, kind of maybe highlight on the show. So we're aware of that as well. But trust me, that's going to be the least of our concerns.
Will you, Ron, be doing the adventures, or are you going to be hosting the show, allowing the other guys to do the adventure while you're talking about it? Or are you participating as well?
I'm participating. So they're basically joining my journey.
Okay.
You know, and maybe they will do it. Maybe they won't. You know, that's where all the drama and the intrigue presents itself.
It sounds fun. It sounds entertaining and exciting. So I'm looking forward to it, man. And I appreciate you just sharing a little bit about it, Ron. So thank you.
Well, thanks for having me. I appreciate it, man.
Time for some final thoughts. One of the proposed rule changes when the NFL owners meet virtually at the end of the month is making roughing the passer penalties a reviewable call. And I am all for it. I think the one-year trial for reviewing pass interference penalties should have continued. It's all about getting the call right. You have the technology. Use it. That's it for this week. Thank you to Ron Dixon and Barry Wilner. Please be sure to download, subscribe to the podcast, share, review, tell a friend. We are on iTunes and everywhere that you get your podcasts. Until next week, I'm Rob Motti, reminding you, make a difference, be a blessing.